Welcome to tonight's webinar, which is for the wonderful podcast, Trauma Resonance Resilience podcast, that you'll all be familiar with. And my name's Lisa Cherry, and I'm your host. And I'm so excited to be with Dr. Karen Traisman tonight. Hi, Karen.
Hello, lovely. I'm very happy to be here with you as well, as always.
Well, it's really interesting because we are going to be talking about changing the culture, trauma-informed services and systems. And for those of you who are on the call live, you can use the chat box for general chat or chatting to each other. But we have a Q&A box at the bottom bar of the screen. Please use that for any questions, because as we progress and as we go on, it's really nice if we can also use the questions in the room to help form and shape what we're going to be talking about today. So I thought that the best way really for us to start is to break down some of the language that we use all the time, because you know as well as I do that people often use the language but don't necessarily really understand what that means. And I say that with love and care. It's just that sometimes we get caught up in using language that we haven't had the time and space to unpick. So I thought we could do some of that to get us going. And what I'd like us to start off with really is when we're talking about culture change, bearing in mind that culture has a massive academic body of literature around what it means, what is it that we mean in the context of trauma-informed culture change when we're talking about culture?
Cool. Just throw us right in there, why don't you? Completely. It's so vast, isn't it? It's so huge. It's kind of like, where do you actually start? But I think absolutely what you're saying there, and I know we have endless conversations, is around meaningful use of language, isn't it? Not just kind of a tick box or a checklist, but actually sort of going into what does that mean, and also what it might mean or look like or feel to me might feel or look something different to someone else. I guess to me, and the importance is huge, because Peter Drucker says organizational culture eats strategy for breakfast, lunch and dinner. And I think that's a huge thing, isn't it? It's kind of, culture is like oxygen, it's everywhere, even if we don't see it. So I suppose to me, organizational culture is the values, the attitudes, the principles, the lens, the biases, the guides, the frameworks, the ways of being that influences how people do things. It's almost like if the organization had a personality, or the organization had an identity, or if the building could talk or the walls could talk, what would it say? It's kind of that, how do we do things around here? And I think when we often talk about organization and people get it confused with practice, we're talking about from staff well-being and wellness. We're talking about access to supervision, not snoopervision. We're talking about how recruitment is done, how induction, what are some of the routines, the rules, the policies, the procedures. So we're looking at the whole sort of how organizations make people feel. So it's looking at the sort of fabric of the organization, and how those values are not just said and language, but how they're embodied, infused into the fabric of the organization. That's kind of the first. Yeah, I'll lead you to go with wherever you go with that.
Well, I thought it'd be really useful to go with that. And I know you are the queen of analogy. If we go with the whole, if the walls could talk, let's enter into an organization that's not trauma-informed. What would the walls say? What would the walls be saying about that organization?
That's a good one, isn't it? I like that. So many things. I think there would be aspects of the organization feeling psychologically unsafe, whether that's feeling silenced, oppressed, not listened to, not valued, that you don't matter, the work that feels trauma inducing or harmful, work that feels that doesn't include people. I think you would see high levels of secondary and vicarious trauma and emotional saturation and burnout. I think you'd see some people who are in empathetic shutdown or protective dissociation. I think you'd see more conflict, more arguing, people with less, motivation, satisfaction, passion, lack of empathy, probably one of the biggest ones. More punitive, more judgmental, more pejorative, more ego-driven, hierarchical, abuses of power. That's a big list. You add some to my list.
Well, do you know what? This is, I don't know if this is, if I'm allowed to say this. Oh, I am. It's my podcast. Just described Westminster. Anyway, that aside, I was thinking about the wall and that wall, staying with that analogy, that wall crumbling, that wall having the paint peeling off, it not being steady, it not being tall enough to reach the roof, you know, all of those kind of things were coming to my mind when I was thinking about that. And so then I started thinking about, well, what does it look like when you go into a space that has a culture that is trauma-informed? And I think when we go into that culture, there's that recognition that I don't think there's ever a point when you can have every aspect of your organization trauma-informed, but you can be in that work, can't you? You can be in that place. And I know when I go into somewhere, the way that I can detect what kind of environment I'm in is actually an embodied experience. Mm-hmm. You know, yes, there's what I can see. Yes, there's what I can hear. You know, I'm experiencing that on a very sensory level, but actually it's how I feel. How do I feel when I go into that space?
Two of my favorite quotes, which you've heard me say loads, but I think speaks to what you just said, is that Maya Angelou one of, you know, people forget what you say, forget what you do, but my goodness, will remember how you make them feel. But also that James Baldwin one, which was used in the context of racism, but I don't believe what you say because I see what you do.
Yes, yes. You know?
And I think that sense of what you just said, of that embodied semantic feeling of kind of, is this somewhere where I feel connected, safe, relational, that is just, you know, talking words out on a page, but it's kind of, you know, words don't mirror actions or actions don't mirror words. It's very easy, as we know, to talk the talk, but it's when it walks the walk. And I think exactly as you enter a space or you're in a team meeting, that way of how we feel, the same as, you know, as you just said, when people are like, we are trauma informed, and we've spoken about that loads, it's not a final destination. It's not a tick box or, oh, we've got an award for being trauma informed. It's an ongoing growth, cradle to grave, womb to tomb. We're constantly learning, developing, growing. Same as me and you, you know, most people, most days we're voice noting, oh, I read this really interesting paper, or, oh, if I could go back, I'd do this. Or it's constantly trying to draw on, you know, you're doing your PhD, drawing on different disciplines and constantly reflecting, thinking, asking, having humility, isn't it?
Mm. And being comfortable with getting it wrong. And I guess somebody's just mentioned Brené in the chat box. And yeah, and of course, yeah, being able to get something wrong requires vulnerability, but more importantly, or perhaps as well as, I'm not sure, but being able to be vulnerable has to be in the context of an environment where it's safe to do so. You have to have the two things. And so getting it wrong has to feel safe. And I do work in lots of organizations where that is something people are really unsure about, really feel really unsafe about. And I try really hard to say to people, I am the master of mistakes. I mean, it's just like a daily basis of getting it wrong and or whatever. And I think that's not something that people are often allowed to do. And I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because that mirrors actually some aspects of education for children, that we don't have this culture of making mistakes, getting it wrong, and everyone being okay with that. We actually have quite a punitive culture for children and young people, and then that shows up then in the workplace. So that's quite a challenge, isn't it?
It's really hard. And it's, I always say the same. I'm like, I cock up all the time. I will put my foot in it. I will say things that irritate or piss people off. But it's that whole thing of, exactly, it takes vulnerability and courage, that no one is superhuman. But also to do that, if I could go backwards, or if I could go back in a time machine, I would change it, or in hindsight, or if I could have a do-over. But I say that all the time. You know, it's the same in social services, Baby P, Victoria Klimbe, where people feel on a witch hunt or fingers pointed. How can we expect, for example, children in foster care to be able to explore, ask, be human, make mistakes, if we are punitive, judgmental, or aren't able as adults to say, oh, sorry, or I learned that? But absolutely, when you're in a culture that makes it feel that if you do a mistake, you're going to be annihilated, or that there's an absolute fear of punishment. And again, I think it takes a lot of people to their childhood experiences of, if I get it wrong, or am I going to be humiliated or embarrassed, or, you know, am I going to be seen as incompetent or not skilled or not tough enough, or all of these narratives and discourses. So completely, I think that's where leadership's so important, isn't it? To be able to model the model about being human, about learning, about, and not in a sort of, oh, we have to have serious case reviews, but just like, oh, what could I learn differently or do differently? Or, you know, as John Dewey says, we don't learn from experiences, we learn from reflecting on them. Often the best learning is from the things that are a bit mishap or a bit skewed, or being able to say, oh, I used to think that, but now that's really shifted or shaped, you know, anything like that. I look at court reports I wrote and I'm like, oh, if I knew what I knew now about language, I would have written that, or I would have done differently, or someone asked a question. It's just kind of a healthy part of life, isn't it, to have that humility and curiosity,
you know? Somebody's just written
Nicola and I worked for a long time.
She's put, marvelous mistakes is something a teacher introduced last year to a class, and it revolutionized how those children approach learning and being confidently vulnerable in their school environment. Marvelous mistakes, I love that. And Sarah's written, punitive society and how making mistakes can be disempowering rather than empowering. So we've got some real learning here as well around leadership, around making mistakes. When we're thinking about culture change, that has to be an integral aspect. And Angela's put, we need to still have that, embrace accountability too. It's a fine balance.
100%. And I think what Angela touched upon there, and I couldn't agree more, it's the same as, we know there are safeguarding practices, there are accountability, there needs to be HR processes, and it is a tricky tightrope. So it's, I think, again, and me and you have spoken endless times about this, it's the both and, it's the nuance, isn't it? It's, people become very binary or polarized of, if it's either this or it's that, and things can be both and all the different shades. And especially, you can be able to think about organizational culture and accountability and personal, and how they conflict or confide. So it's not that whole, oh, we're letting everyone get away with things. That's not, you know, kind of what, that's what Angela's picking up on. It's how do we create the nuance that we're able to do hold two positions at once, those blended mixed experiences. Mm.
You know, that's making me think about when, as we bring our whole selves to work, how we do that in a way that's safe and that's also not about bringing our entire selves to work. You know, it's that balance again, isn't it? How you bring yourself into the space while at the same time ensuring that you're not bringing lots of really difficult private stuff into your work that's preventing you from doing the work that you need to do and doing it well and safely, which was very much on the Breaking the Boundaries webinar that we had last month that people can listen to on the podcast, which really unpicks that a lot more. It's again, it's that fine line. It's contextualization, isn't it? When we're thinking about the nuance and holding two things at the same time. And that can be actually really difficult for people. And I've often wondered if that's something that's come out of, you know, if that's a reflection of the kind of society that we're living in that just really struggles to hold the mess that we are working in mess.
Completely. It's all the texture, isn't it? It's messy, it's muddy, there's not, it's, you know, it's a bit like some of the ACE stuff. It's not a neat bow. It's not trying to fit things. And I think and even now more than ever, you know, with the whole Brexit, with the whole pandemic, we know that we're in a society at the moment. We see it on social media every day. It's either you support this or you support this. You wear a mask, you don't wear a mask. You voted Boris, you didn't vote Boris. It's that sense of, I think, sometimes sitting with the not knowing or the uncertainty, or feeling that one has to have an answer or stick to that, or that we can't have both. And I think a big part of trauma-informed practice is having curiosity, humility, dignity and respect for those differing views. And how can you say what you mean, but without being mean saying it? You know, how can you have that way of trying to also respect and understand other people's perspectives as well, rather than trying to bulldoze a particular way or weaponize trauma-informed practice, which I think is the other thing around organizational culture. Well, you're not doing that and that's not trauma-informed, which actually is not trauma-informed in itself, is it? Because then you're shaming or humiliating or blaming someone. So it's all of those bits.
That just made me think about that whole kind of spirituality thing, you know, like we're all really spiritual here and you're just not spiritual enough. It's kind of like that, isn't it, with trauma-informed practice. You're just not being trauma-informed enough, you know. But I wanted to move us on. So we're thinking about culture. We've got a real sense of what we're talking about. We're talking about culture. So the first place that I land when I want to really dig deeply, and I guess you'll have your first place that you like to land as well. So I'm interested in what other people who are on the call think about this, and do use the Q&A box if you want to ask some questions. The first place I want to land really is language. And I don't know about you, Karen, but every sector I work in, professional language problematizes the person. Absolutely. There's not a sector, if you start to unpick the language used, that has no kind of structural integration and is entirely individualized. And I've been really trying to help people think about that more deeply. And I start with beyond parental control. And I start with that because that category is what was assigned to me when I went into care as a child. And what a title like that does and says, not just about the child, but about the parent or parents, and how that then manifests as an internal narrative as an adult. Mm-hmm. And so that's the sort of stuff I'm really interested in. What when we take language from any sector and unpick it and spend some time with the way we communicate with each other in practice, I'm really curious about how we start to reshape and reform language to shift a culture, because until we can see it, we can't change it. Until we can speak it, we will just continue to perpetuate the way we view the world. Like, it's like a real dance, isn't it? If I change the language, it changes the way I see things. So it changes the way I respond to things, and it changes the way we do things.
Yeah, couldn't agree. You know, that's my favorite day of training I do is about the power of language. I love it. And I think it is the other great thing I always say about language is it's free. It doesn't cost a penny. And yet it completely see a situation differently. You see a different situation, see a person differently. You see a different person. But it's not just the language that we're marinated in from, you know, classic social services examples when someone's pregnant, talking about the unborn, leaving care, you know, is care leaving me or am I leaving being cared for? There's endless. You go to a placement, you have respite, a break from something unpleasant, you know. Case, is someone a case or are they a person? So I think there's all those nuances. But to me, what also happens is people then can get very good at creating, oh, let's really think about language and how we speak in interventions. But I think the difference of organizational culture is, how do you speak in supervision, in reflective practice? What are the brochures or the posters on the wall? How those corridor conversations that we have with people and the language, how our website reflects the language in our assessment forms or our screening materials in a team meeting. If I always say to people, if your team meeting, if a parent or child was sitting in there or an Ofsted inspector, or we released it on Twitter and that's how you wanted to represent your organization, what would it be? And I think starting where we started with the whole organizational culture thing, to me, language is huge because it's everywhere. But it's also, people can get very, and talking of meaningful, oh yes, we're just going to look at how we do our care plans, or we're just going to look at how we do our court reports. And that's brilliant. But actually, it's what people are feeling, seeing, hearing, sensing in that whole organization. What do people talk about when they're in the senior leadership meetings? How is that reflected in the emails that people are sending or communication to the organization? And that's the difference, isn't it, between taking something at a practice level and taking something at an organizational culture system level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then if we bring that back down to the person, the individual, for me, I'm very keen that people understand that you do not label me without my consent. And that is really challenging to organizations. So we've got this constant dance, haven't we? We've got the culture, we've got the what goes on in that culture, we've got the organization, but then we've got all the people who work in that organization and how they interact with each other, how they interact with policy, how they interact with the people using the service, how they support people using the service, connecting with each other. You know, all of those layers really helps us start to think about language as quite a complex aspect of trauma-informed practice. So somebody we have here, Chloe's written in as a question, interested in what you were saying about hierarchy being a sign of not being trauma-informed. There's something about sharing power and being vulnerable or open to collaborative working, but also not handing it over to people who aren't experienced enough to make the decisions yet, just having to pull rank sometimes. What are your thoughts in how to balance this in a trauma-informed way?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and it's a hard one to answer in a general way, because I think it's much easier when there's a specific scenario or a specific example. But I suppose I would liken that to parents. Yeah. Parents as we know, need to sometimes make difficult decisions, convey tricky information, make decisions that might make them unliked or unpopular. But there's a way that, for example, if a parent is making a decision, that it's done in a say what you mean without being mean way, or connection before correction, or that I'm making a decision that's not from kind of punishment or putting you in your place, but it's from a connective experience. It's that whole difference between authoritarian parenting and authoritative, high levels of limit, high levels of boundaries, of supervision, but also with connection, care, love. So I think there's that thing of, I think no one's saying hierarchy isn't trauma informed, but what we know is where there is a place where some voices are prioritized and others are neglected or unseen or not heard. For example, we know in serious case reviews, the most common finding is that someone in a more junior position was not heard or not listened to. Or for example, when people do consultations and you're like, you're just asking me, but actually nothing's going to change. So what's the point of saying it anyway? Or where it feels like people feel devalued, that it's just such a bureaucratic hierarchy that actually it's so much about power that people feel that they're not able to shape or influence in whatever role that might be. That doesn't mean that some decisions aren't made or there can be some structures in place. Obviously, that can be the case. But it's how, again, the nuance within that. I don't know if you want to...
Well, I think what we're talking about here is power, actually. And when power is imbalanced and when power is abused. So I think when we're looking at trauma-informed cultural change or organizational change to trauma-informed ways of working, power is such an integral part of that conversation. So maybe it's really highlighting how we think about power and shifting power. And again, that's something that, you know, I talk about a lot in terms of centering lived and living experiences into creating services. Someone's just put up, I'm not going to repeat all of it because I can't say what's been written, but just, for example, the use of service user. When I think about that terminology, which I equally cannot use myself, I just cannot bring myself to use it. It's really challenging. But it makes me think about what happens when I go and use a service. I don't get called a service user. If you're called a service user, then we all know that means somebody who's either in alcohol services, drug services, mental health services, or probation services of some kind. It's not the same as when I go and see a solicitor to use that service. They're not going to call me a service user. So we know what that means, and that is highly problematic. Someone's put, I use person accessing services. Yeah, or, you know, people that I'm walking alongside is something that I use.
And just to say something, I don't really want to go into the ins and outs of language. Both Lisa and I do separate trainings where we go into the ins and outs of different labels and different terms and all the rest. But again, I wanted to go back to the nuance because, for example, I don't like the word client. I don't like service user. I don't like case. Someone is not a case or a caseload. Talk about people I'm working with or people I'm supporting or names. But I also wanted to go back to the other bit is around nuance. So I often use the example of survivor in the trauma-informed world. Some people love the word survivor, absolutely do not use the word victim. Other people are like, use victim, not survivor. Other people are like, well, it depends how you say it or who says it or the context. Other people are like, I really don't care, you're making a big deal out of it, use whichever. Other people are like, use neither of those. And so, again, I think it's so important that what some organizations do is, oh, we're going to be trauma informed and we've gone on this training and this is a good word and this is a bad word. So we're going to have a language policy. And then anyone who's not in the language policy. And again, it's not about there's this word or that word. Yes, there's certain ones to be mindful of, but it's also having one that the majority of people, but also checking in, creating space, being mindful that it's like the word empowering. I can't stand the word empowering. other people use it all the time and love it. It's not, oh, that's a good word or a bad word. It's being able to be like, this is the word I'm using and my meaning and shape. But if you want to use something else, or how does that land, or what does that feel, and creating a space. So I just wanted to go back to that sort of nuance, and again, not going into the this word or that word. Or there might be some people on the call who are reading, well, I actually use service user and I really like it, or that's helpful for me. So I just wanted to land.
Yeah. And that's why you do not label me without my consent. And that whole survivor victim, it's interesting because I use that as an example as well, because there will be also a trajectory. There will be a point at which I want that label, because that helps me understand where I am and what's happened to me. And then as I go further in my journey, then another word might help me understand where I am at that time. And so I think there's really understanding, you know, there's the curiosity, there's the individual, what works with you right now, what's going on for you. So yeah, really good to bring that in, Karen, thank you. I've got another question. So Jacob's put a great point about the circular relationship between language and the individual. You both have some lovely reflections, so thank you. Thank you, Jacob. My question is, to what point is changing language oxymoronic in its intentions, i.e. changing and moulding language implies it should be changed and that the individual is different? I know this is playing devil's advocate, but it reminds me slightly of the oxymoronic intentions of global mental health efforts and the idealization of Western mental health. Would love to hear your thoughts. Just a small question there from Jacob. Nothing too big for us to tackle there, Karen. Great question.
I'm not quite sure I got all of that question, to be honest, because I haven't read it. So maybe you speak to that slightly because you've read it. So it might be easier than...
So, yeah, I mean, I'm not certain what Jacob's after, but I think he's talking about cultural humility, I think, which is I do not know what I have not lived, I have not experienced. And I also he's put yes, 1,000%. Yes, thank you. That's good. And also it's making me think about mental health awareness as well, and I'm very aware that mental health awareness has done nothing for stigma, for example. So this whole kind of continued effort about talking about mental health and trying to normalize it, and the 1 in 4 posters that were everywhere, etc. hasn't actually helped stigma around mental health at all, one iota. And it certainly hasn't supported the funding of mental health provision. So I guess part of talking about it as an oxymoron is the more we talk about it, it doesn't really get us anywhere. It doesn't really arrive us at a point. So that's kind of what I was understanding by that very, very...
Yeah, I mean, my sense is... And again, I'm not quite sure, so apologies, Jacob, if I missed the point around that with some of the words. But to me, I suppose what we have shown from research over and over again is that change your language, and it not only can change engagement, people's perception, how they hand over to foster carers, to residentials, it can change people's feeling about the organization, people's way of making sense of things, particularly when it's done in a relational, collaborative way. So I think actually there's a lot of evidence around change the language, and it doesn't just change attitudes, lens, perception, but actually can change actions. So I think that's there's lots of stuff actually that it's not just a sort of, because I think some people are like, oh, you know, we can just chat about it, but actually it doesn't make any difference. But actually there are a lot of studies that show, both from the person of the perspective, but also in terms of, we've seen the difference it makes in psychiatric hospitals from amount of seclusions, restraints, from how lawyers demonstrate things, from sentencing, from actually whether people are more persistent, more patient. So there is actually a lot of studies about how effective language can be if it's in a meaningful way, not in a tokenistic way. And obviously there's huge amounts of cultural nuances within that. But yeah, I'm not sure if I'm speaking to them.
I mean, there's some great stuff coming up in the chat box, actually, around, you know, how do you negotiate that language when perhaps someone doesn't have the capacity to discuss the language? What might be more sensitive terminology for somebody seeking services? And I guess from that starting point, I would have to say it's the person's name. You know, like, if that's the starting point, let make that be the starting point. Lucy's also put here, sometimes fine nuance can be missed. So when we have this blanket way that trauma-informed practice is helpful, I sometimes find that those further along the line in their journey of post-traumatic growth can struggle where presumptions of need are made in the name of trauma-informed practice, even if these presumptions come from a beautiful intent to help. Do you know what? That is absolutely something that I've seen. I hear that a lot from parents who have children struggling with their mental health, that there is a desire to dive straight into the trauma conversation, what trauma has happened for this child. And the parents are, I mean, I had a meeting with a group of parents that were just absolutely bewildered because they felt they were being blamed, that there was this whole aspect around trauma. And listen, it's complicated, right? Because there's all sorts of things that can generate an overwhelming response that isn't tended to or buffered. Mm-hmm. And as a parent, I know how difficult it can be to confront your own experiences as a parent and how they've impacted your children, depending on how, what sensitivities they arrived into the world. To do that as a parent, and it's something I've just started trying to talk more deeply about, you have to have really done quite a lot of work to be able to do that as a parent without berating, judging, guilt-tripping yourself. And so to go into a space with parents who haven't come across anything to do with trauma, may not have had their own therapeutic journey, may not be in the field, and to approach them as though there's a trauma issue with their children, I can see how confronting and unhelpful that can be, and how actually the good intentions of there's obviously some trauma here, are actually not helpful for that parent at all, because it's a language, a way of thinking about something that the parents can feel, and I'm staying with that as an example because I've come across that recently, as though they are being seen as the traumatizer. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I think my mind's gone to lots of places which we wouldn't have time for, but I suppose what I'd say is that's people in my mind who misunderstand and weaponize and misuse trauma-informed practice. And that's exactly the sort of thing we're talking about people who say we're trauma-informed, but actually a lot of trauma-informed, you don't mention the trauma, you don't talk about the trauma. There's actually no question or talking about trauma. It's actually about equally having a lens where we're thinking about neurodiversity, sensory integration, the impact yes. of speech on child development. But also one of the biggest things about trauma-informed practice is about how do you take the values and the lens, and then you use that for your particular role. If people think trauma-informed practice is digging or asking people about trauma, or just assuming that someone has trauma and then delving, unfortunately, that is some of the misunderstanding, because in any way, that's kind of completely contradictory with well-meaning intentions. That's not trauma-informed practice.
Yeah. But I think just by taking the time to spell that out to people, I think it's really helpful. You know, it's really, really useful to understand how unhelpful it is to go trauma digging. But that's what I hear.
Particularly if you are not a qualified professional to be doing so. And I think obviously there can be qualified professionals that do harm, but even more so, absolutely. It is not a trauma archaeological dig. It's not trying to go somewhere. It's the lens and the values of trauma-informed practice and using the guided principles. The same as I always give the example of a nurse doing a smear test. You're not asking the ins and outs of the trauma, highly inappropriate. It's how she uses the values and the role to shift how she might undertake that. She doesn't need to ask or know anything about someone's trauma. So I think that is a real, I'd say for anyone who's on that specific journey, that's why when you do training or have conversations, it's really important that people understand the difference between trauma sensitive, trauma aware, trauma informed, trauma responsive, at a practice level, from a clinical level, and from an organizational level. And I think once it starts to, you know, anyone who's talking about trauma-informed, do they know the values? Do they know the R's? What does that mean? What does that look like? That's the news that is more than just, oh, and the same as when you say, oh, we're trauma-informed, but really people are talking about just being nice, then that's not trauma-informed. Trauma comes from a body and evidence and models around the values and the lens of trauma, adversity and hardships.
Yeah. It's really interesting because the amount of spaces I've gone into to do some training, and I'm with people saying we've done trauma informed stuff, we've done this, we've done that. I'm like, really? Like, you know, I'm 30 odd years in and I haven't done it. I'm still doing it.
Exactly.
And I say to them, okay, that's great. So who wants to tell me the principles of the framework? What are the principles, they say? What are the principles? So that's the first port of call for me, because I think if you're struggling with any aspect of whether you're coming from a space of being trauma-informed in the work that you're doing, just go back to the principles. Is it safe? Is it collaborative? Is there transparency and trust? Is there peer support? Cultural humility, you know, are those things in place? Keep it simple, keep it really simple and stick to the principles. That's what they're there for. We've got lovely Chloe has just said, I wandered off to make tea, but I could still hear you. Thanks both for answering. Those reflections were lovely, like the rest of this chat. Now, I haven't read this, but we're just going to dive into stigma. And I'm really interested about this because stigma has come up massively in my research. And it's something that I'm really going to spend some deep, deep time on. And stigma as a word is actually quite contested. But I've decided that it's appropriate in my research. So anonymous person has said, in relation to stigma and mental health, it is thought one of the reasons these campaigns do not have a lasting impact is because it locates these difficulties in the individual as if they are unknown to the public. These campaigns do not usually take into account the context in which someone's mental health can change. Beautifully put. I'm organising an art exhibition of artworks by mental health providers who also experience mental health challenges in an attempt to challenge the stigma and break the them and us polarisation. I feel this adds to the societal stigma and creates an impression that we are immune to these experiences. Bingo, bingo, bingo. Mm. Absolutely. There is no them and us. There are humans at different points. Vulnerability and resilience are the same coin. It just moves around and flips around and it depends what's going on for us. And I'm just proof. I like Karen, I don't know about you, but I review so many books. I'm a little bit selfish because I get paid in books. So
it's a brilliant bonus of it. Yes. Given that we're both geeks.
I know. It's just like, who on earth walks around going, you're never going to believe this, I get paid in books. So I get to see loads of books before they come out, and I'm really, really excited about a book coming out that's really speaking to what happens for this is particularly about teachers. who have experienced adversity when it is so unsafe to be a teacher who's experienced adversity in childhood. And if we, and until we do that and we have the right things in place for people, and by, I'm going to go with Karen's super vision, not snooper vision. And that, I think, having the opportunity to bring your whole self, we're back there again, aren't we? How you bring your whole self to work without that being, without you being unsafe, without other people being unsafe, without the organization being unsafe, because it has all the things in place. I often think about when I was working in leaving care teams back in the 90s, and if I'd have been able to bring my whole self to work, I would have understood my own triggers. Somebody would have sat with me and said, that must have felt really difficult for you. What did that bring up for you? I can see you really struggled with that, and it's okay. With the experiences that you bring that we've talked about, I can see why that was really hard for you. Yeah. Those conversations didn't happen because that didn't happen. So what happens is you don't talk about it and it goes underground. The shame continues. The hiding of aspects of yourself continues. How can you bring your whole self to work when you don't have those places and spaces? So I'm with you, anonymous attendee. These are the things that will really help in relation to stigma. There's also some great stuff in the chat here. Trauma digging, yes, you can have that one. That's straight out of this podcast. And Karen took it to the next level, as Karen does, and an archaeological dig. An archaeological dig. Boom, love it. So yes, so we've had a little look at culture, we've had a little look at language, and we've also had a look at stigma. I'm wondering if there's just one more thing that we can explore as we hurtle towards the end of this webinar. Is there something that you would really, really like people to take away?
Isn't it? I mean,
I like the big question.
You're on one tonight. We're at the end of a long, long year. Yeah, I suppose for me, if I was, there's so many things, but I suppose the two things whirling around in my mind, if we're talking about organizational culture, and there's a few people here tonight who will know because we talk about it all the time, is so many teams, people, organizations with well-meaning intentions talk about we want to be a trauma-informed system or organization. And then when I speak to them, they're like, oh yeah, because we want to work with, you know, around anger, or we want to work around stretching the truth, or we want to work around reducing our adoption breakdowns, or improving our stability for our young people. We want to work at increasing, you know, reducing drugs and alcohol or self-harm. And I'm like, that's brilliant. That's when we're looking, we can do that. And that's looking at it from a practice level. But when we're talking about it from an organizational level, it starts with us. It starts with leadership, with management, with how training is done, with induction, recruitment, language, policies. It's looking at how we do change programs and restructures. It's looking at the physical environment. It's looking at the comms strategy. There is a difference between, and it's the same as when people talk about anti-racism. And I always say, absolutely, we need to give a huge amount of attention to anti-racism. But people often talk about trauma-informed very separately. You cannot talk about trauma-informed without cultural humility. And by that, I'm not just talking about racism. I'm talking about all the social graces, about gender, about sexuality, about xenophobia, homophobia, all those inequalities, biases, discrepancies. It's so important that they are interwoven and intertwined, both. And so my biggest thing that I'd like people to take away is to really think about, if you are looking at this as a practitioner, it is different being a trauma-informed teacher than being in a trauma-informed class, than being in a trauma-informed school, than operating in a trauma-informed Ofsted inspection. They are different things. You might be working towards being a trauma-informed social worker, maybe trauma-informed team, but when I talk about organization, I'm talking about the organizational culture and fabric. And I think that is kind of the next stage for some people on their journey. So that's my little snippet, if that made sense in a very brief way. What about you?
I love it. And in my mind, I'm doing like a Bronfenbrenner on that.
I love it.
I'm doing a Bronfenbrenner on that. We've got
we can get Emma to illustrate it for us.
Indeed. And Emma's actually doing some work for me. She said, we've got to be really careful that your stuff doesn't look like Karen's stuff. And I said, we do. We absolutely do. So she's going to do that. I've just got one more question that I feel like I'm allowed to ask, that's come from Jackie. She's saying that something that came up in our transformation program, and we might not know the answer to this, Karen, it's not my area of speciality. So I'm going to put it to you because it might be something you can answer. That came up in our transformation program today was needing to be both trauma and psychosis informed to prevent missing someone needing help. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of trauma is a lens. It is not the answer. It is not, everything should not be seen as trauma, attributed a trauma. Some people wouldn't even describe or label as something trauma. It is a lens to look at something through. Do we also need to have a neurodiversity lens, a learning disability or intellectual disability lens, a human rights and social justice? Do we also need to be, of course, if you are working with people who are presenting with hearing voices or being aware of dyslexia, dyspraxia, autism, fetal alcohol, it will be different in different ways. So there is a danger in any field of having an attentional bias to only seeing one thing, to being a one-track pony. People are nuanced, multi-layered. Absolutely, we need to be able to hold both and. But the difference with, that's what I was saying about trauma-informed, it's the values and the lens that can be applied. It's not assuming that every person has experienced trauma. It might be stress, adversity, difficult life experiences. The values are useful for everyone, but there might be additional bits around needing support around psychosis or needing support around drugs and alcohol or needing support around having a brain injury. Absolutely. And I think that's what we've been saying the whole time about, it's not the answer, it's about a lens, the values. And if you are going to, for example, intervene with someone about psychosis, you can still do that from a trauma-informed lens using the values of how you might engage with that person or communicate with that person or work with the family or how environments might be used to support. That's the difference. I hope that fits, Jackie, and makes sense with what you're talking about.
Absolutely beautiful. And just staying with that, thinking about neurodiversity, when I get a book to review, if it does not speak to neurodiversity, that is what I send straight back. There has to be something. And I'll tell you why I feel really passionate about it. First of all, we have this complex view, this polarized view, that it's trauma or it's neurodiversity, when actually that does not speak to anything that we know about brain science, which is that we arrive into the world and interact with that world and the relationships in that world. If we arrive into the world with particular sensitivities, particularly a neurotypical world, that is not a great space for somebody with neurodiversity, then some of that those experiences are going to be traumatic.
Yeah.
You know? I had somebody attend a session I was doing, and she was self-described neurodiverse, and she had a little store with loads of sensory things that she'd made to help children that had helped her. And afterwards she came up to me, she said, if you'd have changed the word trauma to neurodiverse, it still would have made complete sense to me. And I think there's something that is being missed around that. So when I get a book to review, I want to see an entire chapter on understanding neurodiversity. And when we know that the children most likely to be excluded from school are children with special educational needs. There's a couple of other groups as well, but just staying with neurodiversity, then we know that we have to respond to that in a different way. So that's where I'm at with that. And you know, Karen, that brings us to just coming up to 8 o'clock. I can't believe how much talking me and you can do.
Really? You can't believe it?
and just in the chat, Liza's put, thanks for the webinar. My head hurts from nodding. Yes, it's so lovely that you've all been able to join us. And thank you so much for coming. And Karen, it's always good to chat with you about absolutely everything. And I think we could probably spend a week having a conversation about stuff at least. So it's been brilliant. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you as always for having me. Always love chatting to you and bouncing ideas. And thank you to everyone for spending a random Wednesday night. Thank you. Sending virtual hugs.
Thanks, Karen.